So what I'm going to try and talk to you about today, and I usually don't get through the full list of what I write down, but I'm going to try and do this, is Z-decay, then input parameters, talking a little bit more about that, as I discussed last time, in terms of how we actually fix some numerical values in the Lagrangian and how we predict things. And then I'm going to go through muon decay in a little more detail and as an EFT example, just to make it kind of clear what's going on there. And then the Z decay, Zs are being made in the collisions of the machine in the 90s, which was called LEP, this electron-positron collider. And those initial states were pretty easy to prepare. Like, well, they're not easy. It costs a lot of money, millions of dollars to make, high-energy electrons and positrons to collide. But relatively speaking, they're a little bit easier to prepare in terms of collisions. Whereas now what we're doing is a Large Hadron Collider collisions, and those are hadrons, those are protons being collided, which are a little bit more difficult to prepare and to basically calculate with. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about the differences in those sorts of scatterings in the standard model, and then how Higgs production and decay we actually are measuring and finding this scalar particle in the spectrum, and that's in these PP collisions, even though it was something we could see indirectly in loop effects at LEP to actually start to see a bump, which corresponds to the Higgs being a resonance feature. We're actually, that's 2012 it took to then. So hopefully we'll get through all of that, but probably we will have to push to the next time we talk. So the Z decays in detail, just to make sure that we got started going a little bit fast last time, so I just want to step back and go a little bit slower on this to make this super clear to you guys. So we have the kinetic term for the fermions. And the kinetic term for the fermions for the Z, we know in the mass eigenstate Z fields that we just write it out in this way. Okay, so this is an operator and this is an operator. And these fermion fields are both the lefts and the rights, okay, which is a bit of a difference compared to the W. When we wrote out explicitly the W coupling, it's just coupling to the left-handed fields, the quark doublet fields or the lepton doublet fields. That's why there's those raising and lowering operators we talked about. But the Z couples both to the lefts and the rights, and then these operators act on the lefts and the rights. Okay? So for the Z, we actually take into account this that it's coupling both the lefts and the rights by decomposing the Z couplings in terms of calculations people do, in terms of one of two conventions. Those conventions are usually written in terms of some decomposition of a current that we write down. So we have these Z effective couplings, and we're coupling to the Z field, and then this is a bilinear current that the Z is coupling to in terms of fermion fields with this overall GZ. Remember, GZ was square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared. And this current, we have a choice now because we have couplings to the lefts and the rights. Somewhat historically motivated, we have something called an axial and a vector decomposition for the Z couplings. Vector is just that it's just the vector coupling, right? It's just the gamma mu coupling to the fermion fields when you combine up the lefts and the rights. And axial is just the axial vector coupling. So it's a gamma mu, gamma 5 coupling for a particular fermion field. So that's one way of taking the coupling to both the left and the right-handed fields. Remember where the projectors are there because there's a left projector and a right projector, and there's gamma 5s, 1 plus gamma 5, 1 minus gamma 5. We combine those things up, and we can decompose it and write it in this way, where explicitly for the different fermion fields, ups, neutrinos, downs, and charged leptons, we now can basically write this as this operator, this T3 over 2, minus the charge and the sign. And this came from the initial mass eigenstate coupling. We're just combining up the left and the right pieces. And the axial is just T3 over 2. So T3 has also historical meaning and convention. T3 is something called isospin. So if you look in the literature, you'll sometimes see that referred to. But for our purposes here, we can just think of it as an operator. Okay, it's an operator that for the particular fermion field, for the ups, the neutrinos, the downs, and the electron, or the charged leptons, it returns either 1 or 1/2 or minus 1/2. It's When you act on this state, it returns a half. When you act on this one, it turns minus a half. Okay? And then the charge, just to remind you, is 2/3. It's 0 for the neutrino. It's uncharged. Then minus 1/3 and then minus 1 in terms of our charge conventions. So that lets you basically take this and turn it into a number for each of the fermion fields. But these are like net couplings, which are effective couplings in an axial and vector decomposition, which is quite often used in the literature. But it's also quite often in the literature, if you want to do these calculations, you can find it's actually quite helpful because you have projectors around, and only the mass terms of the fermions couple the left and the right-handed fields. Sometimes it's useful to think in terms of left and right-handed couplings that go exactly with those left and right-handed projectors. So you don't combine them up into the axial and vector, but you just leave them as left and right-handed couplings. And they have this trivial relationship to the vector and axial couplings. You just, it's the sum and the difference, the effective couplings for sitting in front of the left-handed fields and the right-handed fields. Okay, so this is just the kind of details you should know if you want to basically look at this and compare against the data and compare how we actually do these sorts of calculations. And this, just to reemphasize one more time, is a little bit more complicated than the W case, because in the W case, it was just coupling to the left field. So there's always that left-handed projector coming along with the W's when you have those couplings that goes all the way through. Okay, it's because we have both left and right-handed couplings that we're combining up that we have this. Is that clear? Yeah, good. I thought I went a bit too quick at the end last time. From the feedback, it seems to be the case. So that's how we get these decay widths. Okay, so the decay widths of the Z that we use to consistently precision test the standard model are basically, you take this amplitude, that Feynman rule, which was just a kind of explicitly fleshed out that comes from those couplings, and you are then taking the square of that and then integrating over phase space, okay? It ends up giving you an answer, which is the Z mass, setting the scale of the problem, the initial state mass. Ni is then the color that's there for the final state fermions field. So this is equal to 3 if it's quarks, or just 1 if it's leptons. And the Z decays to both of those. And it's just because there's 3 final states colors that we sum over, right? Because all those decays are there. The quarks carry that color index. Then you just get, in this, this is a nice decomposition to just use, is just the left-handed effective couplings, which we just defined, and the right-handed effective coupling squared. That's what appears. And then there's a phase space factor here in terms of the mass of the final state fermion. This all just came from this two-body decay. And I don't know if you've done actual full calculations of decay widths in detail, but all it is once you have the Feynman rules, you get to the amplitude, you take the amplitude magnitude squared, and integrate over phase space. That last step for two-body decays in a simple case like the Z is really simple, but actually integrating over phase space can be really hard, especially when you start to do, you know, more bodies in the final state. I mean, it's something that, like, if you actually do these sorts of calculations, you can test someone if they do the calculations in detail or not. And if you just ask them, you know, well, was the phase space integration simple? And if the answer is yes, they probably didn't do the calculation. And if the answer is no, then they probably actually suffered through the calculation. So, especially when you have more than two body final states and it's not a clean environment like Z decay. It's just that, you know, it's just math, but it's actually difficult. And if you actually do it with the cuts that are present in the experimental measurements, then it's even harder. So phase space is actually pretty hard, actually, at the end of the day, when you actually do actual calculations. But there's some codes that let you basically numerically do those sort of integrals. But in the simple case here, just this simple case here, you just take the amplitude squared and you normalize. This is a final state momentum. It's, you know, you can go to the rest frame of the Z, so this is going to be equal to P2 as well, and then MZ, and then full phase space integral, which you're not doing any cuts, which gives you just a 4 pi. Okay? And then this thing I mentioned very quickly at the end, this 4 Backerday symmetry, is literally just a 4 Backerday symmetry. It's just basically looking at how, you know, scattering in the forward direction, scattering in the backward direction compared to the, you know, how that actually basically is affected by these left and right-handed couplings. And it's just the sum and the difference of these effective left and right-handed couplings normalized. These individual A size and ALs, which are combined up with a 3/4 to give that forward backward distance. So it's just a measure of the how much you scatter in the forward direction and backward direction for the Z when you go through E plus C minus through a Z to final state fermions. This we can measure experimentally as well. And that leads to some good consistency tests of the standard model. Okay? So hopefully that clears up. Last time I think I got going a bit too quickly on that. Now, if we want to actually test how the standard model is consistent with the data, then we actually have to fix our Lagrangian parameters. Even though I defined those couplings for you, these G lefts and G rights, in here, there was G1 and G2, right? So how do we know those numbers? How do we fix those numbers? We need to know that at tree level and at one loop if we're actually going to make these predictions and compare against what they actually see in the collision at the experimental results. So that's something called input parameters. Okay, and here I'm just going to talk to you about three that we need to actually fix and make these sorts of predictions. And that's GF, MZ, and alpha electroweak. Okay, so when I use hats, I'm usually going to talk about experimentally measured quantities. That's kind of a notational thing I do from the literature. Whereas you'll notice, although I drop them sometimes, I've tried to use bars when you actually do a theoretical prediction, okay? So let me just define this one in detail. What is this Fermi constant? Well, what it is that we extract it from muon decay. Okay, so muon decay is just a muon going to an electron and then two neutrinos. So that's going through a W. Okay, so it's a muon. And that's going through the W. Okay, so it's a 1-to-3 body decay. So if you actually want to calculate this, then you have to do the phase space of three bodies and integrate over three body final states. More complicated than two, it's, you know, there's an algorithm to do it, but to actually execute the integration is a bit of a chore. So the amplitude here, if we just take the Feynman rules in the standard model for having a W coupling to lepton pairs here and here, then you directly can derive it's minus G2 squared over 2, the bar. And then I'm just going to use general fermion fields here. And this has a left-handed projector, which is the case of the W compared to the case of the Z. And then it's just the propagator for the W. And here, I've used Feynman gauge. So I'm taking this Xc parameter, and I've set it equal to 1. So I've killed off the Xc minus 1 k mu k nu piece of the propagator by choosing this value, which is just a gauge choice for the massive W. Okay. Now, if we take this amplitude and we square it, and we do that somewhat more difficult integration over three-body phase space, then we get an answer, which is this, for muon decay. Okay, so it's G2 to the fourth, muon mass to the fifth power, 32 under 92, this all comes from phase space, cubed, and then 1 over P squared minus MW squared, all squared. Okay, so this has the right dimensions for a decay width, 5 dimensions in the numerator for the muon, 4 dimensions downstairs. And P squared, if we do on-shell muon decay, then the muon is the initial state. And so P squared is actually equal to the muon mass squared. Okay? So what is this thing GF, which is the point of this discussion, is to define this? Well, it's actually something that is called the Fermi constant, because Fermi defined it in the 30s, before we had any idea about W's, any ideas about Z's, any ideas about the standard model at all. So all it was an effective coupling for this sort of structure that you can extract from experiment. So that's one of the historically first examples of thinking in terms of effective field theory. He just is like, well, let's just write down the interaction and fit it from the data. And he didn't need to know all of the subsequent 80 years of theoretical developments for that to be a useful thing to do, because that's actually what's present in the data. Okay, so it's actually... Okay, so it's actually defined as the coefficient of that operator form before he had any ideas about the W. So for GF, this effective Lagrangian, it's actually defined as, he wrote it down as, minus, and it's just the coefficient of psi bar gamma mu P left psi, psi bar gamma mu P left psi that you fit from the data, which in this case, in terms of operators, it's just the muon the electron so in this case okay so it's just something that if you measure this decay with you can actually just map and get a number here. And one of the benefits of just thinking in terms of this sort of effective coupling is it kind of simplifies your understanding of what's actually going on. Because if you look at this, you're like, well, what is actually being constrained here, right? It's maybe not so obvious. And it becomes very obvious when we do the expansion that we can do, because the muon mass squared is much less than the W mass squared. So it is an objective fact that the muon mass over the W mass is about 10 to the minus 6, a very small ratio. It's not the square, just these guys. So it's very, very small. So we can obviously expand this initial expression that we had in the standard model that we now know is the correct expression many years after this effective thing was being done by Fermi in the 30s. We can basically say that, well, this, there's a factor here that in the end becomes 1 over... Okay, so if we just calculate all the way through and we keep all of our momentum dependence, it's just sitting there. And if we have that answer and we know that those numbers are very, very, you know, the ratio of them is very small, we can obviously expand at the end. That doesn't lead to any questions about quantum field theory and about divergences and about whether you can really do this sort of thing. It's just the answer. And it's just an answer with this nice approximation. So we can just do, obviously, that expansion. And if we do, we find okay, the muon mass over the W mass, it's a series, right? And this is 10 to the minus 6. Okay, so it's a pretty good approximation to just do that expansion. And the key part of thinking in terms of not just expanding an experimental result, but thinking in terms of an effective theory, is you can do that expansion before, at the start, before you do any of the integrations and integrations over phase space. And when you do loops, you can do that expansion before you do the loops. That's the key thing, which is actually the real benefit. So we're going to expand to see what GF is. And if we just expand it out, well, what do we get? Then the leading coefficient was minus G2 squared over 2 And now we're going to expand this out. Well, the leading term is just the MW squared when we expand the propagator, right? So this is just going to equal, at the end of the day, there's an I here, minus I G2 squared over 2, then 4 G2 squared V squared for just the W mass, expand it out. So this is just equal to minus I 2 over V squared. Okay? So that's a bit conceptually clear, right? What you're actually doing when you measure the coefficient of this operator form is you're actually fixing just the VEV, and not the coupling, but the actual VEV. Okay, it's actually a nice way to measure the VEV. And that's what they actually were extracting in the 30s and 40s when they were doing these sorts of very early experiments, way before we had any idea about a Higgs, which was generating the VEV, or W's, or anything. It's just a number. Okay, so this thing, so minus 2 over V squared, has to be this coefficient, fixing this GF. So that's minus 4, square root of 2, this normalization that's introduced, what we call GF, when we fix experimentally. So we have that GF is 1 over square root of 2 V squared. Okay? So that means that if we just measure this muon decay, that we fix V. And we use V in lots of other places, for example, in Z decay, right? When we do those decay widths, there was a leading mass of the Z in terms of the decay width, which, you know, we need to make the explicit numerical prediction. And I just want to emphasize the key benefit is expanding before integrating when you're actually doing EFT as a theory. Now, why is that helpful? Well, it's just kind of trivial, right? You can just take it all the way through and expand at the end, or you can just expand at the start. Like, who cares in some sense, right? But you know, there's loop corrections. And I know loops are not popular, but that's really the point. So there's a loop correction like this, which has a W, and the photon, there's this. Okay? Now, when you do the expansion before the, at the start, then this is just a loop correction in that expansion for this effective four Fermi operator of this form. Okay? So this is all localized. It's just a 1 over m squared. There's no propagator there to worry about when you actually do the loop integral. Okay? So that just simplifies things. At one loop, you can see it's not a great simplification, but it's at least a bit of a simplification. And the answer here, just in case you're curious, the one loop correction goes as minus alpha electroweak over 4 pi, pi squared minus 25 over 4. Okay? But at two loops, then you also can do this expansion, okay, in an effective theory. And at two loops, that starts to help a lot, right? Because you're going to have a whole bunch of propagators and a whole bunch of momentum dependence. So if you can take some of those propagators, and before you do any integral over d dimensions, any integral over phase space, any integral over Feynman parameters, do the expansion at the start, that helps a lot in terms of making things easier. That's the key benefit. Okay. So just keep that in mind, that, you know, that's why the people that do these calculations, they always, you know, are using effective theories to make things simpler. Because if you can make, you know, 1 over p squared minus m squared just equal to like a hard scale that goes right through all those integrals, it's just a normalization, that makes life much easier. That should be obvious, I hope. Okay, so that's an example of an input parameter. We measure the coefficient of this GF, and we get the V. But there were two others that I talked to you about in terms of the way to make these predictions, MZ and also alpha. We talked about alpha before. So what alpha It's just a photon emission, right? So you basically have the Coulomb potential, which goes as alpha electroweak over R. And you just do these one photon emissions in cold ion traps, and you extract the coefficient of alpha at very low scales. Then we run it up. Again, a loop effect. We go through the pions, and we get alpha of mz. Okay? So once you know alpha, remember alpha electroweak is equal to g1 squared, g2 squared, over g1 squared plus g2 squared, 1 over 4 pi. So now we have GF fixing V, and we have alpha fixing a combination of the couplings, but not the individual couplings yet. So we need one more thing to fix the things separately. Okay? And that's the Z mass itself. So again, we fit literally, well, badly drawn, but we fit MZ. We scan through the Z peak in this experimental program, and we actually figure out what MZ is fitting this curve. It's just a Britt-Wigner resonance. Okay. And we fit this, and then we have mz extracted, which is g1 squared plus g2 squared, v squared over 4. Okay. So now we have two measurements involving g1 and g2, and we have a separate clean measurement involving v. So we can get G1, G2, V, and make predictions like Z decay and consistently test this whole theory. Okay? So there's also things like sine that appear in the Feynman rules for the Z, right? Which, remember, was a particular coupling over square root of G1 squared minus G2 squared. So I'm going to leave it to you as an exercise to go through to actually show this, and you should be able to do this. It's a kind of informative. So show this to yourself, that you get this funny expression for sine. Okay. And that this actually is equal to sine squared theta that appears in the Feynman rule for the Z. So it's just a nice exercise to go through. Maybe it's obvious. You can just plug the relationships for this in and see that it works, but it's kind of perhaps useful for you to go through that and see. Okay, so once we know E from alpha electroweak, we know V from GF, and then we know MZ, so we know individually the G1s and G2s. Then we can predict all the things at tree level and even at loop level in the case of Z decay, for example, and also things like Higgs production. Okay. But wait, you should have stopped me. You should have questioned this. And you should have, well, not necessarily should have, but it's good to have your trust, but there's a problem in this reasoning, which is the muon mass was sitting here. This is what we measure, right? So we actually needed the muon mass to get to that 1 over V. All right, so how did we measure the muon mass? So the way we measure the muon mass is actually a bit of an interesting story. Let me just briefly sketch it out to you so you get the idea that there's a whole series of measurements. So how do we measure m mu? Well, modern, very precise measurements of muon decay, or for muon masses, actually measure something called muonium. And what's that? That's actually a bound state of positively charged muon and the electron. Okay? And what they actually do is they actually measure the Zeeman spin orbit coupling. And what they do is they extract, this is just a sidebar so you have an idea of how this stuff works, the electron mass over the muon mass in this system. So they just do perturbation theory. They see, you know, Zeeman alpha, you know, splitting. You can look up the emission lines for this system. They just study. Do they see this difference in masses by studying those as bound states? So if we knew the electron mass, we would then have the muon mass from measurements of that system. And then we could use that to get V. But this is in a book someone looks up, right? But how do we actually measure the electron mass? We need to know that too. Actually, we need to know the chain of things like this. So you might have done this. I think you probably did this at some point in your like first year physics laboratory, right? Where you can actually measure how the electron moves if you have a magnetic field. And it's really F equals MA. So you have an electric field plus the velocity of the electron. And they use F equals MA to basically get the electron mass over the charge of the electron is equal to E . So if we knew the charge of the electron, just by doing this simple first year laboratory, we would know the mass of the electron. If we know the mass of the electron, we can then study muonium, get the muon mass very precisely, and use that to now know the VEV very precisely. And the way we get this, you might recall, is in the oil drop experiments. Just seeing how the electron moves, right, in an electric field. So this is just a sidebar to reemphasize the point that it's always of experimental results. It's always a combination of experimental results that we're actually testing. And if you look into the details and you just take a number from a book, you know, it's really always the case. So all we know is that the consistency of all these experimental tests with the standard model modern description, so far, were consistent. And we look at the most precise test to see the most precise sort of constraints we can get on physics beyond the standard model and how well it works. Okay? So in the time remaining, I want to talk to you about a little bit of aspects of QCD and Higgs production and decay. So this is a way, hopefully it's fleshed out now, how we have consistency tests of the standard model just in the properties of the Z from some other experimental results, other experimental measurements. But now we have this like robust experimental program going on now and for decades to come at LHC, which is the Large Hadron Collider, measuring many properties of Zs again and Ws, but also properties of the Higgs. So those collisions we need to think about if we're going to think about production and decay of the Higgs. Okay? So E plus E minus through a Z to psi bar psi, that was LEP. And now it's PP collisions through hopefully a Higgs resonance, in measuring the properties of the Higgs, to some final states. And this is a whole set of final states at LHC. Okay? So it's a hadron collider. So remember, what is a hadron? Okay, it's a bound state QCD. So remember we had this sort of coupling. I'm being a bit careful now with my indices. For the quarks, with three generations of quarks, I'll make this a J. But this was the color index. So this A ran from 1 to 8. This beta and alpha is 1, 2, 3, runs from 1 to 3. This should be beta. And this is in the adjoint representation, the coupling of the gluon field, which is labeled with A. Okay? So there's three types of color. Which is what this index running from 1 to 3 means. So usually they're called red, green, blue. There's nothing, you know, deep about that. It's just a way of saying 1, 2, 3 with, you know. And there's three types of anticolor. It's like red bar, green bar, blue bar. And if I'm careful about indices, color and anti-color will be upstairs or downstairs in these sorts of couplings. It's both the upstairs and downstairs indices, which are like the 3x3 matrices that you get for the Gell-Mann representations for couplings into the adjoint. Okay? So, but there's just color and anti-color. And then gluons, in this way, through this coupling, they carry combinations of color and anti-color, right? So all the different ones related from 1 to 8, you can think of as red, blue, bar overlaps. That's what these couplings are, for example. That's exactly what this is, okay? And it's just, you know, Slepch-Gordon decomposition in terms of the couplings of the different states. That's really what it boils down to. So because we have G mu nu for our gluon field strength, and we expand it out, and remember G mu nu and it has these structure constants, A, B, C. Because we have these non-abelian couplings from this field strength, we have Feynman diagrams like this, right? Four-point couplings, which just comes from this part squared. We have also couplings like this, where we have gluon, 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 gluon. And both of those things are not present in QED. But they are present in this non-abelian gauge theory. And we can actually just calculate them directly. We know these structure constants. And we can just expand out and get the Feynman rules quite directly. The important phenomenological consequence of these extra couplings being around is, like, unlike the Coulomb potential, which was just the case of QED, now we have this potential when we try and separate two quarks. The strong coupling, B is a function of R, which grows. So as you try and pull two quarks apart, it requires infinite energy to actually isolate a quark and pull it out from the other quark, which is very unlike the case of QED. And it follows just from it being non-abelian field theory with the particular coupling constants that it has and the running behavior that it has. Okay? So we have bound states. Which are hadrons for the scattering that we're going to do at LHC, where the quarks are bound inside protons. So you have both two different types. bound states. You have things called mesons, which are QQ bar bound states. And you have then hadrons, like the proton and the neutron, which actually have three constituent quarks.
Okay. Or a baryon. Another notation, QQQ. Okay? And then the proton and the neutron is an up, up, down. And the neutron is up, down, down. Okay? So the charge of the proton and the charge of the neutron, this one, if you work it out, is equal to just E. And this one is equal to just zero, just from the constituent quarks and adding them up. Okay, neutron, proton. Charge one and neutral. Okay, so now we have to use scattering, where we have, unlike in the Kc plus d minus, we have these protons coming in. And their wave function. And then we want to basically have a collision. And we would like to get something like a Higgs, for example, out. And then some final states. And there's an issue here because of the way that the potential runs and the fact that these are bound states as to how you actually describe this scattering. So how would you want to describe this scattering? You could basically say, well, these guys are made up of just these quarks. So maybe what I should do when I talk about the scattering of them is I should talk about the scattering of just the individual quarks. And then figure out how you produce Higgses that way, and then how would they decay. But you also have in the proton, which has these three quarks, the possibility that you could have a gluon, and that gluon could then split into some two other quarks. And in terms of the wave function of the proton, this happens. So you can resolve and you can have extra quarks being produced. Or you can also have the situation where you have the gluons just splitting. So in a sense, there's also constituent gluons in this scattering. Okay? So when we actually do this scattering, we need to take all these accounts into all these effects into account. This is actually a huge effect in terms of the production of the Higgs and then and how we actually make it. So the way we actually do this is something, so these are partons, and the gluon is also a parton. It's a part of the proton or part of the neutron. Okay, so when we do this sort of scattering, we need to basically have functions to describe how these things are created and how these are existing in the wave function, and then do the scattering, we have to integrate over those distributions. It's not like E plus E minus, where it's a clean initial state. Well, actually, even in that case, if you accelerate something with a charge, electron or positron, it creates a photon cloud. So it's kind of similar. So that always happens. But it's a much bigger effect in terms of proton-proton scattering. So we have to really take it into account. So the way we do this is we say, for the individual scattering states, we get a cross-section for PP collisions. And what we're going to do is we're going to integrate over some fraction of momenta, one of these distributions. And it's a function, so it depends on x and it depends on energy scale for some initial state. We're going to integrate over another one. So if we wanted to do 2-to-2 scattering and describe that in terms of these distribution functions for some other parton, and then we will have a hard scattering, which has to do with these states 1 and 2, going to final states. So these functions tell you how, with a hard scattering that you'll write down in terms of Feynman diagrams for initial to final states, how you basically embed those in the proton, which is a bound state object. They're called parton distribution functions. Now, we can't calculate these. We have to just fit them from the data, just like those other input parameters. We have to fit lots of stuff from the data. They measure a lot of different like a lot of different states. We have some idea of how, as a function of x1 and x2, that these guys should go, and as a function of energy, they should change. x1 and x2 is that you have a proton, and you want to basically relate it to some individual parton. So x1 is the momentum fraction for the initial state, one of the protons. And x2 is just the fraction of momentum that a parton carries from the other proton. So we have some phenomenological understanding of how these functions should behave, but we have to fit them from the data. Okay? And it depends upon QCD as to how big they are. And essentially, it's taking into account the effects of the splittings and the gluon scatterings that I was telling you about. Okay, I need to stop. I'm just going to talk about one thing. So, and then we'll talk about the rest of Higgs production and decay. So when we think about Higgs production and decay and how big things are in terms of scattering, we need to figure out these, which come from amplitudes, which we can get from the Feynman rules. And then we have to also worry about how big these things are in terms of the collisions. So when we do proton-proton scattering, even though it's made of up-up-down, essentially, because of the nature of these functions, in terms of the scattering that we're doing, it's a gluon-gluon collider, the LHC. The proton, the parton distribution function for the gluons is much bigger. So we should think about initial state gluons, and if we want to talk about the production of the Higgs, when do initial state gluons give us the Higgs? Okay? Well, there's no tree-level coupling of these to the Higgs, but there is this diagram for gluon and gluon, and this is the top. And remember, this is basically an order one coupling. This is called gluon fusion for production of the Higgs. Okay, this is the biggest effect, essentially, in terms of producing the Higgs, simply because these functions are so big compared to the other parton distributions. So we can calculate this directly as a partonic scattering. And a simple way to think about it is that you could just take the diagram. If you just want to talk about the partonic nature of this and forget about these distribution functions for a second, that's going to make it so the effect is big. But we can just think about this diagram and squaring this. And we know two-body phase-space integrations are pretty easy. So let's just think about Higgs decay to two gluons, just to think about how this thing behaves. Okay? So just like the decay of the Z, we can write it down. It has alpha couplings here, so this is just G3. So that's an alpha strong squared. GF, which we just talked about, so it's set by the scale V. We have 64, square root of 2, pi squared. And if it's Higgs decay to glu-glu, just like the case of the Z, setting the Z mass in the initial for a momentum scale, we get a Higgs mass now. And it's actually, if we wanted to do all the fermions, a function. I don't want to go over in time, so I'm going to have to stop in a second. Where this is just a function which basically tells us about this loop. Okay, so we expect that to be a function of the top mass and the Higgs mass. And this tau, in the case of the top, this tau is exactly the mass of the fermion squared, mass of the Higgs squared with a 4. This is just a function. It's actually a simple thing that you can derive. So F1 half is equal to minus 2 tau for a fermion internal state psi, minus 2 tau psi, 1 minus tau psi. And then this is either Or it's minus a fourth, and then it's a log. 1, square root of 1 minus tau, 1 minus square root of 1 minus tau, and then plus I pi. This is all squared. And this is for the case here. This is what you get when tau is greater than 1. This is what you get when tau psi, depending on the masses, is less than 1. Because this just gives you, you know, it's another example of how once you start to do loop corrections, things get a bit complicated in terms of the formulas. This is just an answer you can derive just doing the momentum integrals and explicitly evaluating. So I don't want to go too much over time, but remember for the top, so I'll just stop in this. We have tau greater than 1 because MT is 173 GeV, and that's actually bigger than the Higgs mass. So we can take the tau goes to 1 limit of this term. Okay? And the leading part of it is just minus 2. Then you get corrections that go with, you know, actually it's a function of 1 minus tau. So this is, again, just like in the case of the muon decay, when we're taking this limit, this is the answer at the end, right? And we have the masses, and we can do the limit because we know the explicit masses. But remember, we can also do the expansion at the start. And that's what leads to the benefit. If we do the expansion at the start, in terms of taking this, you know, the Higgs being, the mass being smaller than the top, then you should expect this to shrink down to a point. Now we're getting rid of the internal momentum behavior, and it's just being shrinking down to a point, which is just like with this normalization, just like in the case of Fermi decay. But this is an operator of this form. And that's not dimension 4. That's dimension 5. Okay, so the mass dimensions are made up by V. So I'm going to stop because I'm going over time. I'll go on to this more on Monday next week in terms of Higgs production and decay. But this is yet another example how even in the standard model, once you take useful limits, you actually get simple local operator structures. And you can actually figure out the coefficient here, just like the Fermi coupling coefficient, from actually taking the standard model amplitude and doing the expansion at the start. And it's just directly derivable. And it's just, once you have that, it's a simpler way to get this decay width, and also the production glue Higgs as well. So we'll get back to that on Monday. I'm already over time. And we'll do the other sorts of production and decay of the Higgs. Are there any questions? Okay, I'm gonna stop because I'm over. I'm already over.